Hello and welcome to this special presentation of Heritage Radio Network. My name's Kat Johnson. I'm the Communications Director here at HRN. And today I have a special guest in the studio with me. Stephen Satterfield is the co-founder of Whetstone Media. He's a self-proclaimed origin forager. Stephen Satterfield is a food writer, multimedia producer, and founder of Whetstone Magazine. And before his career in media, he was a social entrepreneur advocating for wine as a catalyst for economic development for Black and Indigenous wine workers in South Africa's Western Cape. Welcome, Stephen.
Thank you so much for having me, Kat.
So we were chatting a little bit before we started and having some pizza, and you were telling me a little bit about your background in wine and specifically with working in South Africa. Can you take us kind of through that journey and what got you started in wine to begin with?
Yeah, let's see. So I got into wine at a very early age in life. I was still a teenager. I enrolled in culinary school in Portland, Oregon, in the hospitality and restaurant management program. And part of the curriculum was wine education, sort of like an intro to wine class. And I really took to it. I had a cursory interest in high school. So like my senior year in high school, I was leaving school early to go home and cook along with Julia Child and Jacques Pepin. So a little insight into my youth. And then I went to University of Oregon from Atlanta. And after my first year of college, I decided that college wasn't for me. And I really felt strongly that I wanted to pursue a career in some fashion in culinary arts. And so I went into this hospitality and restaurant management class, had my first formal education around wine, and completely fell in love with it. And so by the time I was 21, I was a sommelier and was working on the floor in Portland, and that was really the onset of almost 10 years of working in some fashion in the wine business.
Was it hard to kind of study wine as you were not 21
Since
yet?
I couldn't drink.
Yeah.
yeah, it was really a funny thing because I was the youngest person in my class, and I don't think it ever really occurred to anyone that there were any minors in the class. You know, it just wasn't a thing that came up. And the same for, you know, the program. It was the International Sommelier Guild was the name of the skill that I tested through. And so it wasn't until basically I was being awarded this certificate, you know, that there was some like requisite paperwork because my boss paid for it, you know. So there was at no point in which kind of like my identity was part of the God, I hope I don't get anyone in trouble. This was so long ago, though.
It's water under the bridge. Oh, yeah. It's wine under the bridge.
Wine under the bridge. It's all gone. So, yeah, that it wasn't really a thing because I was already really deep in the community of wine. And, you know, being in Portland, started to befriend a lot of people who are working in the Willamette Valley. So it was just all around.
Was there a wine or a moment in your education that kind of flipped the switch for you from knowing you were gonna do food to I'm all in with wine?
Mm. No one's ever asked me that. Yeah, I remember, that's a really good question. So I remember tasting wine by this producer named Steve Doriner, who makes wine at a winery called Christom. And of course, so much of the early wine education is about describing the flavors. And, you know, one of the things that often comes up with Pinot Noir is like barnyard and funk and these kinds of descriptors. And I understood it intellectually, but I hadn't really seen or felt that terroir in practice. And the first time I was exposed to his wines, I think I was 20, I just remember being like, oh, this is like, this is the thing. Like, this is what everyone is referring to. That is almost like kind of dumbing down his wines because he's still one of my favorite producers. But the notion of terroir outside of this like sort of fantastical construct really hit me as an appropriate framework to evaluate the quality of wine and also as a jumping off point to think about wine as agriculture.
And you're originally from Atlanta, and then you did go back and spend some time as a sommelier in Atlanta. What was that period of your career like?
Yeah, that was, you know, I moved back to Atlanta and I worked as a sommelier at Restaurant Eugene for a summer. I had a great experience working there. Really, at the time, I was just getting this nonprofit off the ground. So, yeah, my journey as a sommelier, you know, I'm a black man, and it is and was a really kind of predominantly white space, which is totally fine. But at a certain point, I just felt like there was I wanted to see more of me in the space, and I wanted to kind of deepen the conversations or my own understanding about what was happening outside of the restaurants. And so I started feeling really weird about serving these really high-end wines to people who I really wasn't able to relate to as a young black person. And so I moved back to Atlanta and I decided to start a nonprofit that would basically, you know, our mission was basically to use wine as a catalyst for socioeconomic development in the Western Cape of South Africa. So I was really fond of South African wines. And, you know, as I was learning more about the history of South Africa, it struck me that there was a lot of parallels in, you know, their struggle for liberation as our own history in Atlanta, you know. So I found that to be like a really profound thing for me. And it felt like a point of entry into something more real. So we started working with black owned wineries. And so the South African wine industry, I mean, it sounds pretty esoteric, but it actually makes sense when you learn about the history, because, you know, it's one of the most important agricultural, industries in South Africa, multi-billion-dollar industry. And at the time in 2008, I believe there was only two black wineries in South Africa. And the black and indigenous make up over 90% of the workforce and basically of a multi-billion dollar industry. And they had 0% ownership or representation. And, obviously, you know, I thought that was really messed up, but I also felt like, okay, I'm a sommelier. I speak this language. I have a background. Like, this could be an opportunity for me to, you know, connect more deeply with something I really care about. And also, kind of a social mission as well that was resonant.
So what did the nonprofit do on the ground?
Yeah, that's a good question. So on the ground, what we really wanted to do was basically start kind of like a wine of the month club with our roster of wineries. But that was really complicated to do in 2008 because each state is basically its own country in the way of wine laws. And many states have relaxed their wine laws since then. But we had to kind of move off of that idea and essentially became like a nonprofit, broker. So we would find other importers and, you know, link them up with producers. Or in some cases, I mean, what we really ended up doing was kind of acting as a marketing entity on behalf of, these black and indigenous wineries. And so that's actually, I mean, that's really how I got into making media. Is because I was working with a filmmaker, I was doing newsletters, I was early on social media promoting these wines, and it started to become really natural for me to educate people about food and to use media as a means of education.
And so how soon after that does Whetstone pop into your mind?
There's quite a long time. There's a lot that happened. You know, that was, we were a nonprofit and that was in the thick of the recession. So truly the worst time imaginable to begin a nonprofit. But we were able to let it write. I mean, we did have some success. We were able to ride it out for about 3 years. And after the World Cup, I remember we had a huge, like, international food, music, and arts tour. We did a bunch of events and fundraisers, and I was just so burned out. You know, there was so little money, and I was working so hard that I decided I needed a reset. And so I moved to California in 2010, and I started working at a restaurant called Nopa, which is a fabulous restaurant in San Francisco. And I was hired there as a manager, which I wasn't really excited about. I kind of wanted to enter as like maybe a busser or something a little bit.
Really?
Well, because, you know, it was so much responsibility to run this nonprofit, and I was still like in my, you know, mid-20s, and I just kind of wanted to chill for a little bit. But they wouldn't let me chill. They were like, if you want to work here, this is the only position that we're going to hire you as. And so I actually did turn down the job, but luckily I had some friends in the Bay Area who knew the restaurant really well. And they were like, no, this place is totally ethically aligned. Like, it's a nice restaurant, but you're going to really get along with the owners, which proved to be true. And I managed at Nopa for a few years. And by kind of the second year that I was there, I really wanted to tap back into the creativity around storytelling, particularly at the point of origin, because I was getting really close to the producers and that we were working with in the Bay Area. And so I convinced them to let me start kind of a multimedia company within the company called Nopalize. And these are fortunately really successful restaurants, and so there was no PR or anything like that. And I basically said, like, why don't we use what is this phantom marketing or PR budget and take ownership of the stories? You know, I really didn't feel like the paper or the blogs were able to represent how dynamic the restaurant was. I mean, because what made them special is that they were not just buying from local farms, but they were so committed to facilitating a real relationship between the farmers and the people who worked there. It was a real community. And it's hard to represent that when you're on the outside of it. And so I worked with a bunch of creatives all over the Bay Area. They basically gave me like a monthly trade budget. And so I would go up to like a filmmaker and be like, yo, I know you love Nopa. Like, I got $500 if you want to do this video on like how to make a cocktail for Nopa or something like that. Or like we'd go to a farm or something. And it was pretty slick. We ended up with, you know, kind of our own little podcast series. We probably did about maybe 60 or 70 videos and hundreds of different blogs. We did, you know, tours for the public. So that was a really illuminating thing for me. I got really into media. That actually became my full-time job at Nopa, which culminated in 2015, at which point they basically said like, hey, this thing is like, you know, getting kind of big and has less and less to do with our restaurants. Like, maybe you ought to go figure this out on your own. So they kind of politely kicked me out of the house. before they did that, they're kind enough to basically say like, what would you need to realize some manifestation of this in real life? And I said, you know, I really want to continue with these kind of purveyor centric or origin centric stories, but instead of local food culture of Northern California, I want to do the local food culture of the world. I want to come up with like a brand that represents that. And so they gave me a check for $5,000. And they were like, okay, go find someone to help you. So I hired a designer, a genius designer, on the cheap, because we had already had, you know, an existing relationship. And we went through the whole branding of Whetstone, what was to become Whetstone. And at the end of the process, you know, we had our own like typeface, we had the logo and all this other stuff. And so I went back to the owners of Nopa and I was like, okay, I got this thing called Whetstone and I'm gonna go pursue it. And that was literally my last day at work. It was just over.
Wow.
Yeah.
Why? How did you land on the name Whetstone?
You know, a lot of people who have had the non-enviable position of having to name something will know, like, just kind of how annoying that whole process is. So I was working with a team of three people, like, you know, some friends of mine who were in the marketing space. Whetstone, for me, it was a name that I submitted because I loved, there was two things about it that I really loved. The first of which is that I felt it represented kind of like a secret handshake, some insider knowledge, which is basically, you know, most people think about the first step for a chef is like, you know, chopping the vegetables or starting the prep. But really, the first step for a chef is to sharpen the knife every day. And so there was something around the ritual of sharpening the knife on a daily basis, and obviously the connotations of, you know, honing and getting sharper through this ritual was really resonant for me. And so we voted on it and we stuck with it. And I love it. I love the name Whetstone.
And when did the first issue of the magazine come out?
Came out in the spring of 2017. So yeah, it was late in the fall of 2015 when we first got the idea. I spent the entire year of 2016 really just flailing around, utterly clueless. I tried to do a crowdfunding campaign. Actually, we raised, the original vision for Whetstone was really supposed to be kind of like Nopalize. We wanted this multimedia channel. And so I did a Kickstarter. We set a goal for $50,000. We raised about half of that, and I had to give it all back. And so I almost quit right there. It's still hard for me to talk about because we've never come close to raising that much money since. But and it was a tricky time as well because my friend who I had started the project with actually that year also died in a car crash. He was a really young man, and we were really close. I mean, this was a shared vision for both of us. So that was a rough year, you know, and I was really ready to let it go. But as I moved through the grieving process, it became really clear to me that the best way forward, the best way to honor my friend, was just to like figure this out. And so I just figured it out. I mean, I luckily had a network of food professionals or stories that I had in mind. And so I begged people to work with me to buy into the vision. I really sold the vision of Whetstone. I mean, luckily we had a lot of clarity around what we were trying to make. And so clarity ends up being its own kind of currency in a way. You know, you can't really take it for granted. Sometimes people are really well capitalized and they try to go figure out what to do once the capital's there. And we had no capital, but we had a really clear vision about what we wanted to make. And we leveraged that vision into really talented writers and designers. And the first one came out and it really felt like on the mark of what we wanted to do. And I just used that. I put it on a credit card. And then we started selling direct to consumer, and pretty much that's been the nature of the relationship. I mean, we're in retailers, but mostly Whetstone has been all about hustle and, you know, one-to-one relationships at mainly $20 increments.
So when you're working with a writer to publish a piece in Whetstone, what are you looking for in that piece?
Right now, most of the pieces that we get are stories that are pitched to us, which is a fortuitous position as an editor. It wasn't the case for the first couple. But what we're really looking for are stories around food that really speak to a sense of place. So we say Whetstone is about food origins, culture, and anthropology. So the origins is kind of, and the anthropology kind of self-explanatory. You know, we write stories about like the origins of wine and viticulture, the origins of corn, the origins of cacao. Really looking at food from a super long, like 8,000 year lens. So we love all those anthro stories. And then there's a lot of like food and identity stories, you know, the subtext, as you can see, kind of a recurring theme in my life around representation. You know, I thought that having a black editor with, you know, kind of working on a global food publication was in itself its own kind of radical act. And I, you know, it's like one thing that I love about our magazine, is that, you know, you have, where I believe that I'm the only black publisher, you know, of a food publisher. And so the contributors to our magazine look different than the contributors to every other magazine. And so, I mean, it's a little bit more on the surface now, but at that time, you know, it was slightly less on trend to talk about representation in media with such urgent terms. And so I have really been fortunate that I feel the magazine, in addition to just cool subject matter, has really been reflective of the world of food, and the people who are telling the stories aren't necessarily professional writers. In fact, we're oftentimes working with people who have never been published before, but they live in different parts of the world, or they're using food as a means of exploring their own identity. And so we have this kind of broader food culture tip, which is mostly manifesting through people using food as a way to go deeper, you know, with their own history. And we love that. You know, people are able to see themselves reflected in a magazine in a way that isn't cheesy, that's really authentic. And, you know, there's so much power in that.
So I wanted to ask you a couple things about the latest issue, which is the summer 2018 issue.
Mm-hmm. We have the fourth one's coming out next month, just a couple weeks.
Awesome. So this one from last year, you start with a really awesome piece that I love, Bringing Poppy Seeds to Puerto Rico by Alicia Kennedy, who's mm-hmm. a friend of the station.
Nice.
We love her. Why did you choose to, I mean, this is obviously has a lot to do with the aftermath of Hurricane Maria, and it's Alicia telling the story of bringing poppy seeds to some of her friends on the island when mm-hmm. she had the first opportunity to go visit. And it seems like such a small thing, but it was a big deal to those who couldn't source mm-hmm. a seemingly simple ingredient. Why did you decide to start this issue with that story?
Good question. That's a really good question. You know, honestly, a lot of those decisions around kind of prioritizing the order is really just about an innate feeling, you know, a vibe. But the reason that I wanted to start off with that one is because of the length. The design. So she actually was able to put us in touch with an artist who's from Puerto Rico, who did an incredible job. I believe her name's Rosara Rodriguez.
Yes.
And she did an incredible job with the illustrations of these beautiful poppies. And so I just felt like, you know, the cadence was right in terms of the length, the quality of the writing, and the illustration. We have some stories that can run long, you know, but I think it's good for people to just like begin to dip their toe into our work with something that's maybe like a little bit more appropriately paced. But, you know, to your point, I love this story because I think like so often the hard part about, you know, tragedy or hearing things about politics, it just all feels so far away, and it's hard to know how to connect to those stories. I mean, we all have a sense that it's awful, and we feel that people have gone through devastation and loss and grief, but I find that it's when we get these more nuanced stories, right, about the ways in which people's lives have been turned inside out. Obviously, like, you know, losing your home is one kind of tragedy, but losing little things that give us comfort and that really kind of make up, you know, it's part of a composition of our own identity. Like losing those little bits of yourself in tragedy in a way is almost equally as tragic, right? Because physical infrastructure can be replaced. But, you know, the comfort of poppy seeds in this case is like, in a way, almost harder to access than the physical shelter. So I just thought it was really nuanced, and yeah, it's a great story.
It is a great story. I also think that you're mentioning that food identity mm-hmm. is like one sort of theme that runs throughout, as well as this origin story. And mm-hmm. I love that she really goes into like some pretty thoroughly research yes. about poppy seeds and what the implication is.
That's Alicia
with
for you.
U.S. Yeah. trade.
And yeah,
it's fascinating.
Yeah.
Another theme that seems to run throughout a lot of the stories in issue three is water.
Mm.
And the different ways that water, whether it's with harvesting sea salt or mm-hmm. whether it's People bringing food to market on a river. Mm-hmm. Was that something that was intentional, or is it just that you can't really ever divorce food waste from water?
No, you're super clever. Now, it's actually honestly never even occurred to me that that was a theme in the magazine, but you're absolutely right. And yeah, same idea. You know, I think with water, again, it's just so hard. Like when you hear about droughts or, you know, irrigation, like unless you're living from working on the land, it's hard to be connected to that. I mean, even as a food professional who shops at farmers markets and goes to visit farms, like that's stuff that you only understand like on the paper. But when you understand water, for instance, the story in Vietnam from Jessica Hernandez, who was writing about floating markets in Thailand. And it's really, really cool because you see water as kind of central to food, but not in the ways that are immediately apparent to us. You know, it's about oftentimes a migration of people and product. That is the story of food. It's all about migration, whether it's forest or not. And water is really central, you know, to our food traditions and our food cultures, no matter where we are.
And then one other thing I noticed was there's a lot of different types of bread, but at the end of the day, bread's bread. Mm-hmm. And it seems to sort of tie these seemingly unlike cultures together.
Totally. That is actually what I love about Whetstone. You know, when we have stories from like Iran or Mexico or, you know, New Mexico, right? We start to see recurring patterns. Like, for instance, on the cover of the second volume, we had this image of fish being air dried in South Korea. And we just completed today, actually, we do these little, we call them dispatches, where we drop into like a different part of the world and create these little videos. So we did one from England. And then today we just shared one from the Gambia, from the Tanji fish market. And really it's all about how they use air and smoke to preserve their fish. But you see these kind of recurring themes or food traditions all over the world from people who look nothing alike. And in making those connections, it's easier to find a common humanity within it. And that's ultimately kind of what the soul of the magazine is all about. You know, it's using food as a way to get to more difficult conversations. It's using food as a way to find yourself. But mostly, I think it's about food as a means of empathy. And the more we're trying to help deepen people's understanding of food, because the more you understand, the more capacity you have to love, or the more capacity that you have for empathy, which, you know, I think we could all use a little bit more of these days. And I think, you know, food is the easiest way for us to get there.
So Whetstone is now growing a little bit into Whetstone Media, which mm-hmm. kind of harkens back to what your original vision was and what you were doing with NOPA, mm-hmm. doing some more multimedia projects. Can you talk about what you have in the works and how the media company is going to grow?
Yeah. I mean, like I said, you know, we're now getting closer to what I've wanted to do all along. It's really hard to, you know, be an independent publisher. So it seems like a ridiculous trajectory to be like, okay, the path of least resistance is to start a magazine. But actually that ended up being the case for us. And, you know, it wasn't that I had some kind of real foresight around that. It was just because that was the only thing that was available to us, obviously creating, you know, especially with film is a much more costly form of media. So, I mean, I think for us, because we have this clarity around what we're trying to make, we want to see that manifest across all different platforms and channels. So the most significant video work that we've done to date was in the Republic of Georgia. So we released last month a short film called Wild Grapes. It took almost 2 years to make, but basically I went to the Republic of Georgia for the first time in 2015, after, you know, my last day at NOPA. Decided, okay, I need to go to Georgia. Wine has always been a big part of my life, and I wanted to go to learn about where wine came from. And I remember I got there and I was feeling so confident about, like, okay, these are the stories I'm going to write. This is going to be my angle. And when I got there, I never felt smaller or more ignorant in my whole life, because I had really committed my life to wine, you know, up until that point. And there was just so much I didn't know, you know. I just felt like I was being introduced to wine again for the very first time, you know, with the grape varieties and the techniques and the language. It was super far out. So I took a lot of notes. I really humbled myself, and I knew that at some point I wanted to go back to Georgia, you know, with a camera to go deeper on some of the stories that I was exposed to. So in 2017, I convinced one of my very best friends, who's also a genius filmmaker and who's become a partner in our media company, David Alexander, to visit me basically on spec, you know, out of pocket, flying from London to come to the Republic of Georgia to go in these really remote villages where there wasn't going to be internet. It's just like there's no pre-production in the way that we think about running pre-production for a professional set. So he really took a leap. But I think it comes through in the film, because it's really clear that there is a kind of intimacy that was established that I don't think we could have gotten to if it was so meticulously produced. So basically, Wild Grapes is a story told in three acts, but we basically look at wine and the history of wine in Georgia as, you know, from an 8,000 year arc, you know, and really examine the ways in which it's permeated the culture. So, and we have a couple more projects coming out this year, which I can just vaguely say we'll have a follow-up Wild Grapes. So there will be another one
in Georgia, or a new location,
a new location.
Okay.
We did something, from the Gambia, but we're really interested in exploring the continent of Africa as well, which we've done a little bit on in the magazine, but obviously Africa's huge.
Yeah, it's a big place.
So we feel like there's a lot more that can be done there. And we've done, and not only us, I mean, I think in general food media, especially American food media, has just not been great about, you know, covering stories from the continent. Not that it's easy, but that's kind of like a direction that we're interested in pursuing.
We were mentioning Jessica B. Harris as someone, obviously, who's been writing about the diaspora for a very, true very queen. Long time. Is there anyone else that you, like, would hold next to her as someone who you think is doing storytelling the way it should be done and covering the...
Honestly, no one can stand next to Jessica Harris. I really mean that, too. I think that a lot of us, you know, of a certain generation who are new or newer to this work, you know, we might be familiar with her work in a cursory way or with her, but like, not really, you know. I mean, everything I'm saying about Africa, Jessica B. Harris was doing that stuff in the early 70s. And, you know, she was doing it for national magazines back in the 70s. I mean, she was so, so, so far ahead of her time. Her research around rice, I mean, again, talking about Senegal and Gambia and West Africa, like, she really created a blueprint for me, I feel, in a lot of ways, about how to think about food, how to write about food. She's a much better writer than I'll ever be. But, I have so much reverence for her that... I can't imagine who else I would kind of hold alongside her. But let's see, who else do we like?
Who else do we like?
Like a lot of people.
Yeah.
I think that, you know, our work, I feel, is kind of, at least in the moment, you know, we're kind of singular in our focus. I know there's another really cool magazine called Eaton Magazine, which is kind of more like a food history magazine. And we're part of a community of, you know, independent publishers, food publishers, that are kind of, I think, part of a rising tide. So I feel very in community, you know, with the moment and with other publishers. But I also feel like, you know, with there's a lot of things about Whetstone that is we're the only ones who are really doing it in the way that we're doing it.
And one of the last things that I have to ask you about that I mentioned is rum agricole.
Yes.
Because you wrote a piece for Esquire, mm-hmm. Esquire last year, saying that it's like the next big spirit. Mm-hmm. And I'm curious, there's a lot of things to be fascinated about with rum agricole specifically. First of all, can you tell us a little bit about what is rum agricole? What differentiates it from just rum?
Yeah, so rum agricole is basically agricultural rum. So most rum that we drink is derivative of molasses. And agricole is rum that is derivative of the sugar cane juice. And so the flavor is much more pure. It's much more assertive. It's grassy. It's super funky. It almost is not, it ought to not be called rum. Like it almost needs its own category, which is, I guess, you know, what the French were thinking when they were in Martinique, you know, developing this particular style of rum. So yeah, I think, you know, I've noticed that I have started to see it, you know, in more restaurants, in bars. I think that'll continue to be the case. But the thing about rum just in general as a category is that, you know, spirits are not cheap. But when you get to the high end of spirits, it's like it becomes less and less attainable. You know, the simplest things to think about are like the Japanese whiskeys or, you know, some really rare bourbons, for instance. But with rum, it's like if you spend $100, you know, you can do so much with that $100. And because agricole hasn't really been on the minds or the palates of consumers or a lot of beverage programs, then it's just a category or a subcategory that I feel is kind of nascent, you know, for the industry. And again, it's changing, but it makes sense to me when you look at the value and the quality, the same thing that happened with mezcal, you know, kind of in the early days of mezcal and, you know, rum agricole doesn't have a Ron Cooper equivalent, who is the, you know, really the pioneer that brought mezcal to the U.S. with everyone has seen the green Vita mezcal bottles, now ubiquitous. But even as recently as 10 years ago, you know, mezcal's behind the bar. It seems hard to imagine now, but it just wasn't a thing so much, or it was definitely an esoteric thing. So when I look at spirits, and I'm an enthusiastic drinker, like I love tea, coffee, wine, everything, I drink it all. And when I, you know, examine like spirits, everyone always wants to know what's next. It just feels like the most obvious next step
is rum agricole.
I mean, I don't want to overly encourage people to drink it because I want to keep it affordable.
Yeah.
And not like what happened with mezcal, but you know, rum agricole, I think there's many, like in Haiti right now, for instance, there's a rum that's getting a lot of press called Clarine, which is not called agricole because that's just in Martinique, but it's basically made in the same style, or like cachaças, for instance. But I think it's, you know, for people who are into mezcal, for people who like clear spirits with a lot of character and spunk, it's just hard. I mean, my favorite cocktail is a tea punch, you know, with just...
Can you explain what that is?
Yeah, it's just like a little bit of, well, here we use like simple syrup, and then squeeze a lime over ice. So simple, but, you know, obviously Samin is like getting all the shine for her salt, fat, acid, heat framework. So kind of along the same lines, you know, with like the acid and a little bit of sweetness. And they tend to be like a little bit punchier, like kind of higher proof. And so I love the spice and I just love that funk and character. And it's just perfectly kind of tempered by just a little bit of lime and just a little bit of sugar. Excellent drink.
I was wondering, since agricole has such a, like, you have terroir in it where you lose a lot of that when you're working with molasses as your base for a rum. Do you see a link between your love for agricole and your love for wine?
No question. The whole thing about wine, like, it changed my life. And the life-changing event was the discovery of terroir. Because, I mean, you can see in our work still, you know, we, that kind of application, that worldview, I'm still applying to food, to drink, to everything, because it is a really useful way to kind of think about a place, you know, everywhere, no matter where you are, it has its own agricultural history and traditions. And so if there is a point of reference, you know, in that history, then it's a really exciting thing to refer back to, you know, to evaluate what you're drinking.
And I just, on the topic of terroir, I had to go back to the latest issue because one thing that popped out to me that I loved was in a story about seaweed and eating different seaweeds, the word miroir is used.
My homie Kevin Kelly. Miroir is good. I had actually never heard that until...
Is it an invention or was it a word?
I can't take credit for it. I think my friend Kevin Kelly, who's mentioned in that article, is he's the first person that I've ever heard use it. So if I'm not appropriately crediting someone else, I apologize. I just wasn't familiar with your work. But yeah, you know, God, seaweed. I mean, talk about something else that is already bubbling, but it's just going to continue to explode. Mainly because of its regenerative properties. I think we're getting a lot more sophisticated and mindful about not just like farm to table, but the next kind of evolution of that ideology, which is about regenerative agriculture and sustainable agriculture. And definitely seaweed is at the very top of that list. But also just for culinary applications, you know, I think it's just a really cool time to be doing this work because a lot of chefs are on this journey with us, you know. Like when I look at JJ Johnson, he's got his rice restaurant or grain restaurant that I think it just opened or is about to open. And basically what he's doing is, you know, getting grains from all over the world and then, you know, remixing it as like something that it seems like ubiquitous or cheesy, like a grain bowl or something. But it's really deep because there's so much scholarship in actually bringing that vision to market. You know, same with Eduardo Jordan in Seattle. Like if you go to June Baby's website, he's got a glossary on there, which is so dope, like of all the ingredients. It's like there's a real commitment I find among chefs more and more to really not only want to, you know, obviously make delicious food, but to have the ingredients be about some kind of a historical connection. So I feel, yeah, it's like we're just here in the right moment in time, and it's an amazing thing to be able to cover. And, you know, I'm just excited to, as our food culture, collective food culture of the country continues to mature, then, you know, we're going to be exposed to different flavors and varieties of things that we thought were extinct or, you know, haven't had contact with in dozens or hundreds of years. And it's going to open up like new pockets on the palette for us. You know, it's a whole new kind of colorscape to paint with.
Awesome. Well, last question for you is, what's the info for the next issue? When's it coming out? Where can people find it? And also, where can people just learn more about Whetstone Media?
Yeah, thank you for the opportunity. So if you go to whetstonemagazine.com, you can find out all things Whetstone Magazine. The next volume comes out in about 3 weeks. So mid-February. We have a cover story of a sorghum harvest from Indonesia. We have a story from the Siwa Desert in Egypt about people fertilizing date trees, which is really rad. We have a story written by a Native American woman in New Mexico. So same vibe, you know, kind of more of what we've been delivering on. So you can subscribe to the magazine or buy the magazine there at whetstonemagazine.com. And if you want to check out some of our film work and some of our forthcoming audio and film projects, you can just go to whetstonemedia.co, not com, because we couldn't get it. Not yet. One day we're going to get it.
You'll get it.
But right now, yeah, whetstonemedia.co. You can read about our creative services that we offer and check out all of our film projects to date.
Incredible. Well, Steven Satterfield, thanks for joining me today to talk about Whetstone and your journey through our crazy food world.
Our crazy food world. Thanks, Kat Johnson.
All right. Yeah, I'm Kat Johnson for Heritage Radio Network. Thanks for listening.